of it to their own family. This was not always possible in Shadowhunter weddings, on account of sometimes your whole family and all your friends had been eaten by snake demons. You never knew with Shadowhunters. But Simon thought it was kind of beautiful that Gia Penhallow, consul and most important member of the Clave, was standing as Sejines to give her daughter Aline to the tainted, scandalous Blackthorns, and to receive Helen into the bosom of her family. Aline had had some nerve suggesting it, Gia had had some nerve agreeing to it, but Simon supposed that the Clave had already effectively exiled Gia's daughter. What more could they do to her? And how better to politely spit in their eye than to say, "Helen, the fairy girl you spat on and sent away, is now as good as the consul's daughter." What is a Shadowhunter made of, if they desert their own, if they throw away a child's heart like rubbish left on the side of the road? Julian was the one standing to give Helen away. He stood in his gold-inscribed clothes, his sister on his arm, and his sea-in-the-sunlight eyes shone as if he was happy as any kid could be, as though he had not a care in the world. Helen and Aline were both dressed in golden gowns, golden thread glittering like starlight in Aline's black hair. They were both so happy. Their faces outshone their gowns. They stood at the center of the ceremony, twin suns, and for a moment, all the world seemed to spin and turn on them. Helen and Aline drew the marriage runes over each other's hearts with steady hands. When Aline drew Helen's bright head down to her own for a kiss, there was applause all throughout the hall.
"Thank you for letting us come," whispered Helen after the ceremony was over, embracing her new mother-in-law.
Gia Penhallow folded her daughter-in-law in her arms and said, in a voice considerably louder than a whisper, "I am sorry I must let you be sent away again." Simon did not tell Julian Blackthorne about meeting Mark, any more than he had told Mark that Helen was not there to care for the Blackthorne children. It seemed hideous cruelty, to load another burden on shoulders already burdened almost past bearing. It seemed better to lie, as fairies could not. But when he went to Helen and Aline to congratulate them, he stepped up and kissed Helen on the cheek, so he could whisper to her, "Your brother Mark sends you his love, and his happiness for your love." Helen stared at him, sudden tears in her eyes, but her smile even more radiant than before. "Everything is going to change for the Shadowhunters," Simon thought. "For all of us. It has to." Simon had special permission to stay the night in Idris, so he'd not have to leave the wedding celebrations early. There was going to be dancing later, but for now, people were standing about in groups talking. Helen and Aline were sitting on the floor, in the center of the Blackthorns, like two golden flowers who had sprung up from the ground and bloomed. Tiberius was describing to Helen, in a serious voice, how he and Julian had prepared for the wedding. "We went through any potential scenario that might occur," he told her, "as if we were reconstructing a crime scene but in reverse. So I know exactly what to do, no matter what happens."
"That must have been a lot of work," Helen said.
Tiberius nodded.
"Thanks, Ty. I really appreciate it."
Ty looked pleased. Drew, wearing her flower crown and beaming ear to ear, tugged at Helen's golden skirts for her attention. Simon thought he had rarely seen any group of people who all seemed so happy. He tried not to think of what Mark would have given to be here.
"You want to go for a walk down the river with me and Izzy?" Clary asked, nudging him.
"What, no Jace?"
"Eh, I see him all the time," said Clary, with the comfort of familiar and trusted love. "Not like my best friend."
Jace, who was sitting talking with Alec, Alec, who once again had not addressed a single word to Simon, made an obscene gesture to Simon as he left with Isabel and Clary on either arm. Simon was not actually fooled that Jace was angry. Jace had hugged him when he saw him, and more Simon was coming to believe that he and Jace had not had a relationship in which they hugged before. But apparently, they were huggers now. Simon, Isabel, and Clary went walking down by the river. The waters looked like black crystal in the moonlight, and in the distance the demon towers gleamed like columns of moonlight itself, Alicante was beautiful in the winter, a filigree city where ice complemented glass. Simon walked a little more slowly than the girls, not used as they were to the strangeness and magic of this city, a city most of the world did not know existed, the shining heart of a secret and hidden land. Simon was used to the academy now. He would no doubt get used to all of Idris in time. So much had changed, and Simon had changed too. But in the end, he had not lost what was most precious to him. He'd been given back the name of his heart. Isabel and Clary looked back at him, walking so close that Isabel's waterfall of raven hair mingled with Clary's fiery sunset of curls. Simon smiled, and knew how lucky he was. Lucky compared to Mark Blackthorne, who was locked away from what he loved best. Lucky compared to a billion other people, who did not know what it was they loved best of all.
"Are you coming, Simon?" Isabel called out.
"Yes," Simon called back. "I'm coming." He was lucky to know them, and lucky to know what they were to him, what he was to them. Beloved, remembered, and not lost.
The Fiery Trial. Read by Sam Heughan.
Simon was starting to wonder about the fires. The fires didn't like him. The fires moved around. That seemed paranoid. Outside, the trees were bare and the grass was brown. Inside, even the mold had retreated to its winter quarters between the stones in the basement walls. Shadow hunters didn't believe much in central heating. The academy had fireplaces, never too close together, and never near enough to anyone. No matter where Simon sat, they were at the far end of the room, crackling away. The elites tended to get into the rooms first, and they took the fireside seats. But even when they didn't, even when everyone entered at once, Simon ended up furthest from the fire. When you're cold, a crackling fire starts to sound like gentle, mocking laughter. Simon tried to dismiss this thought from his head, because clearly the fires were not laughing at him. Because that was paranoid. There were several fireplaces in the cafeteria, but George and Simon had stopped trying to get seats near them. Simon had enough to worry about. He was looking at his plate. He'd also told himself to stop doing this. Stop thinking about the food. Just eat the food. But he couldn't help himself. Every night he teased it apart. Tonight looked to be some kind of stir-fry. But it appeared to have bread in it. There were peppers. There was something red. It was pizza. Someone had stir-fried a pizza. "No," he said out loud.
"What?"
His roommate, George Lovelace, was already shoveling down his dinner. Simon just shook his head. These things didn't bother George in the same way. Back home in Brooklyn, if Simon had heard that someone had stir-fried a pizza, he would not have been upset. He would have assumed that some hipster restaurant had decided to deconstruct the pizza, because that is what hipster restaurants in Brooklyn do. Simon would have laughed, and maybe at some point it would have become popular. And then there would be trucks that sold stir-fried pizza, and then he would have eaten it. Because that is how Brooklyn works. And because pizza. Best guess in this situation, maybe someone dropped the pizza. Or it broke up in the middle of cooking, and for some reason, the only conceivable solution was to put it in a pan and wing it. The problem wasn't the pizza. Not really. The problem was that the pizza made him think of home. Any New Yorker confronted with bad pizza will mentally return home for at least a few moments. Simon was born and raised a New Yorker in the same way the elites were born and raised shadow hunters. It was part of him. The hum and the throb of the city. It could be as rough as the academy. He knew to look down for rats on the subway tracks or near the edges of public squares. He was trained instinctively to swerve to avoid getting splashed with dirty snow slushed by cabs. He didn't even need to look down to step over puddles left by dogs. Obviously, there were better parts than that. He missed coming over the Brooklyn Bridge at night and seeing the sweep of it all. The city lit up for the night. The grand, man-made mountains, the river surging underneath. He missed the feeling of being around so many people doing and making amazing things. He missed the constant feeling of the whole thing being a magnificent show. And he missed his family and friends. It was the holiday season now, and he should have been at home. His mother would have already taken out the menorah that he had painted at the do-it-yourself clay workshop when he was a kid. It was bright, decorated in thick, messy strokes of blue, white, and silver paint. He and his sister were in charge of making potato pancakes together. They'd all sit on the sofa and exchange gifts, and everyone he cared about was just a short walk away, a subway stop, at the most.
"You've got that look again," George said.
"Sorry," Simon said.
"Don't be sorry. It's okay to be miserable. It's the holidays, and we're here."
This was what was so great about George. He always got it, and he never judged. There were many downsides to Shadowhunter Academy, but George made up for most of them. Simon had had good friends before. George was like having a brother. They shared a room. They shared their misery and their small triumphs and their terrible meals. And in the competitive atmosphere of the academy, George always had his back. He never reveled in doing something better than Simon, and being built like one of the lesser Greek gods, George often did excel at physical things. Simon felt his spirits buoy again. Just that George knew what he was thinking, just having his friend there, it was everything.
"What's she doing here?"
George asked, nodding his head at someone behind Simon. Dean Penhallow had appeared at the far end of the room, near the laughing fireplace. She didn't usually come to dinner in the cafeteria. She never came near the place.
"Your attention, please," she said. "We have some wonderful news to share with all students at the academy. Julie Beauvale, Beatrice Mendoza, please join me."
Julie and Beatrice stood at the same time and looked at each other with a smile. Simon had seen that kind of smile before, that kind of synchronized movement. That was Jason Alec all over. The pair made their way through the room. Chairs scraped as people made way, and there was the lightest murmur. The fire laughed and laughed and popped and laughed. When they reached the end of the room, the dean put an arm around each, and they all faced the school body.
"I'm pleased to announce that Julie and Beatrice have decided to become pair bataille."
A sudden rush of applause. Several people stood up, mostly in the elite track, and hooted and called out. This was allowed for a few moments. Then the dean raised her hand.
"As you all know, the pair bataille ceremony can only be performed until the age of 18. It is a serious commitment, a bond broken only by death. I know this news will cause many of you to consider whether you will find a pair bataille. Of course, not all shadow hunters have a pair bataille or even want one. In fact, most of you will not. That is very important to remember. If you feel, as Julie and Beatrice do, that you have found your pair bataille, or if you want to speak to someone about any part of the ceremony or what it means, you can speak to any of us. We're all here to help you make this most important of decisions. But again, congratulations to Julie and Beatrice. In their honor, there is a cake this evening." As she spoke, the lurking evil that were the academy cooks were bringing out a large, uneven cake. "You may now resume your meal, and please do have some cake."
"Where did that come from?" George asked. "Those two. Pair bataille."
Simon shook his head. Shadowhunter families twined around each other like climbing vines. It was easier to find your lifetime partner when you started from birth. Many at the academy were strangers. Julie and Beatrice in the elite track had more connections to each other, but Simon had never gotten the idea that they were that close.
"Well, that was a surprise," George said in a low voice. "You all right?"
It had hit Simon like a bit of a blow. He had thought of asking Clary to be his pair bataille. But pair bataille were like Alec and Jace, training together as Shadowhunters since they were kids. Sure, Simon and Clary had known each other that long, but not in the throwing knives and killing demons way, except in video games, which unfortunately did not count. Simon started to move the idea of pair bataille into the mental category of things he probably would not have. He was training all the time. He hadn't seen her. He was very good at making up excuses. He'd chickened out. He had seen his birthday coming like a giant countdown clock. Every day he told himself it was too late. Clary had come the day before his birthday, bringing him a Sandman omnibus as a gift. By then, he told himself the countdown was over. The buzzer went off in his mind. He was 19. He'd tried to put it out of his mind. But now, looking at these two newly announced peripatae, he delivered himself a mental kick.
"It's not for everyone, Si," George said. "Come on, eat up, and we'll go back, and you can tell me more about Firefly."
In the evenings, Simon had been expanding George's cultural education by explaining the plot of every episode of Firefly, one by one. This had become a pleasant ritual, but it too had a countdown. There was only one more episode to go. Before they could do this, the Dean made her way past their table and stopped.
"Simon Lewis, if you would please come with me for a moment."
People from other tables glanced over. George looked down and poked at his pizza fry.
"Sure," Simon said. "Am I in trouble?"
"No," she said, her voice flat.
"No trouble."
Simon pushed back his chair and stood.
"I'll see you back at the room, yeah?" George said. "I'll bring you some cake."
"Sure," Simon said. Many people watched him go because that is what happens when the Dean gets you in the middle of dinner. Most of the elites, though, had clustered around Julie and Beatrice. There were laughs and squeals, and everyone was talking very loudly. Simon worked his way around them to get to the Dean.
"This way," she said.
Simon tried to pause by the fire just for a second, but the Dean was already moving toward the door that teachers used to enter and leave the cafeteria. The teachers didn't eat with them all the time. There was clearly some other place, some other dining room somewhere in the academy. Katerina Loss was the only one who came regularly, and Simon got the impression that she did so because she would rather brave the terrible student food than sit around with a bunch of shadow hunters in a private room. Simon had never been in the hall that the Dean led him down. It was more dimly lit than the halls the students used. There were tapestries on the stone walls that were certainly as threadbare as the ones in the rest of the school, but they also looked more valuable. The colors were brighter, and the gold threading had the glint of real gold. There were weapons along the walls. The student weapons were all in the weapons room, and those had some kind of safety to keep them in place. If you wanted a sword, you needed to undo several straps to get it down. These were placed in simple holders, making them easy to snatch at a second's notice. The noise of the cafeteria shrank away within the first few steps. Then there was quiet all around. The hall was a series of closed doorways, and the silence crowded him in.
"Where are we going?" Simon asked.
"To the reception room," the Dean said. Simon looked out of the windows as they passed. Here the glass was a quilt of tiny panes held together by lead piping. Each diamond of glass was old and warped, and the overall effect was like a cheap kaleidoscope, one that showed only dark and a very lightly falling snow. It was the kind of snow that didn't amount to anything on the ground. It would just dust the dead grass. The technical term for that level, he decided, was an annoyance of snow. They reached a turn in the hall. The Dean opened the first door after the turn and revealed a small but grand room, with furnishings that were not in the slightest bit broken or threadbare. Every chair in the room had legs of the same length, and the sofas were long and comfortable-looking with no visible sags or stuffing. Everything was upholstered in a lush, grape-purple velvet. There was a low table made of cherrywood, and on it was a massive and elaborate silver tea set with china cups. And sitting around the table on the fine-quality chairs and sofas were Magnus Bain, Jem Carstairs, Katerina Loss, and Clary, her red hair bright against her light blue sweater. Magnus and Katerina were together at the end, near the fire. Of course, it was, as in all other rooms, at the far end. Clary looked up at Simon, and though she smiled as soon as she saw him, her expression suggested that her invitation to this little party had also been recent and not well explained.
"Simon," Jem said, "so good to see you. Please, have a seat."
Simon had only had a few encounters with Jem Carstairs, who was apparently as old as his wife, Tessa Gray. They both looked amazingly fit for 150 years. Tessa even looked pretty hot. Maybe Jem looked hot too. As Simon had thought once before, he probably wasn't the greatest judge of male attractiveness. Was it weird to think that people who were twice as old as your grandparents were good-looking?
"I'll leave you to it," the Dean said, and again there was something missing in her tone.
It was like she had just said, "I'll just give you this dead snake." She closed the door.
"We're having tea," Magnus said.
He was measuring out spoonfuls of loose tea leaves into the strainer of a tiny teapot.
"One for each cup, one for the pot."
He set the tiny tea canister aside and picked up one of the large silver pots and poured steaming water through the strainer into the teapot. Katerina was watching him do this with a strange fascination. Jem looked at Ease in a white sweater and dark jeans. His black hair had a single dramatic streak of silver in it that stood out against his brown skin.
"How are you finding the training?" he asked, leaning forward.
"I don't bruise as much anymore," Simon said, shrugging.
"That's excellent," Jem said. "It means you're finding your feet and deflecting more blows."
"Really?" Simon said. "I thought it was because I was dead inside."
Magnus dropped the lid back onto the tiny tea canister very suddenly, making a loud clanking noise.
"I'm very sorry to interrupt your dinner," Jem said.
He had a formal way of speaking that was the only thing about him that really showed his age.
"Never be sorry about that," Simon muttered.
"I take it the food in the academy isn't its best feature."
"I'm not sure it has a best feature," Simon replied.
Jem smiled, his face lighting up.
"We have cakes here and scones. I think these are of a slightly higher quality than you're currently used to."
He indicated a china plate full of small cakes and scones that looked very edible. Simon didn't hesitate. He grabbed the closest scone and shoved it in his mouth. It was a bit dry, but it was better than anything he'd had in a while. He knew crumbs were falling out of his mouth and onto his dark T-shirt, but he found himself not caring.
"Okay, Magnus," Clary said. "You said you would explain why you brought me here when Simon got here. Not that I'm not happy to see you, but you're making me nervous."
Simon nodded and chewed to show he agreed and backed Clary up 100%, as best friends were supposed to do. At least he hoped he was communicating that.
Magnus pulled himself up. When a very tall warlock with cat eyes pulls himself up to attention, it changes the mood in the room. There was suddenly a real air of purpose, with an undercurrent of strange energy. Katerina sank back into the sofa, dropping into Magnus's shadow. It wasn't like Katerina to be so silent. Katerina was the blue-tinted voice of reason and minor rebellion in the hallowed halls of the academy.
"I've been asked to bring you both a message," Magnus said, twisting one of the many rings that adorned his long fingers. Emma Carstairs and Julian Blackthorne are to become pere batai. The ceremony requires two witnesses, and they've asked for you to be those witnesses.
Clary raised an eyebrow and looked over to Simon.
"Of course," she said. "Emma's a sweetheart. Definitely I'm in."
Simon was mid-reach for another scone. He drew back his arm.
"Definitely," he said. "Me too, but why couldn't they just send us a letter?"
Magnus paused for a moment and looked at Katerina, then turned to Simon with a wink.
"Why send a letter when you can send something truly magnificent?"
It was a very Magnus thing to say, but it rang a little hollow. Something about Magnus seemed a little hollow. His voice, maybe.
"The ceremony will be performed in the Silent City tomorrow," Jem said. "We've already arranged permission for you to attend."
"Tomorrow?" Clary said. "And we're just being asked now?"
Magnus shrugged elegantly, indicating that sometimes things like this just happened.
"What do we have to do?" Simon asked. "Is it complicated?"
"Not at all," Jem said. "The position of the witness is largely symbolic, much like a wedding. You have nothing to say. It's just a matter of standing with them. Emma chose Clary."
"I can understand that," Simon said. "But Julian wouldn't choose me. We hardly know each other. Why not Jace?"
"Because Julian isn't particularly close to him either," said Jem. "And Emma made the suggestion that you and Clary as best friends would be meaningful witnesses for them." Julian agreed.
Simon nodded as if he understood, though he wasn't sure he did, really. He remembered having spoken to Julian at Helen and Aline's wedding not long ago. He remembered thinking what a weight he had on his slight shoulders, and how much he seemed to hold contained, hidden, and within. Perhaps it was simply that there was no one else Julian cared for enough to stand as his witness. No one he looked up to. That was incredibly sad, if so.
"In any case," said Magnus, "you're to stand with them as they go through the fiery trial."
"The what?" Simon asked.
"That is the true name of the ceremony," James said. "The two pere batai stand inside rings of fire."
"Tea's ready," Magnus said suddenly. "Never let it sit for more than 5 minutes. Time to drink up."
He poured two cups from the small pot.
There's only two cups, Claire said. What about you?
The pot is small. I'll make another one. These are for the two of you. Drink up. The two cups were presented. Clary shrugged and sipped. Simon did the same. It was, to be fair, exceptional tea. Maybe this was why English people got so excited about it. There was a wonderful clarity to the flavor. It warmed his body as it went down. The room was no longer cold.
This is really good, Simon said. I don't really do tea, but I like this. I mean, they give us tea here, but one time I had a cup that had a bone in it, and that was one of the best cups I had.
Clary laughed.
So what are we supposed to wear, she said, as witnesses, I mean.
For the ceremony, formal gear, for the dinner afterward, regular clothing, something nice.
Wedding stuff, Katerina finally said. It's a lot like a wedding, but without the romance and flowers. That was Jem. Magnus was now eyeing them intently, his cat eyes glistening in the dark. The room had gotten very dark indeed. Simon gave Clary a look that was supposed to mean, this is weird. She responded with a very clear look of response that said, super weird. Simon drank his tea down in a few large gulps and returned the cup to the table.
It's funny, he said. It was just another Peripatai announcement at dinner. Two students from the elite track.
That is not uncommon for this time of year, Jem said. As the year draws to a close, people reflect, they make decisions. The room had suddenly got warmer. Had the fire gotten higher? Had it sneaked closer? It was definitely crackling loudly, but now it didn't sound like laughter. It sounded like breaking glass. The fire was speaking to them. Simon caught himself. The fire was speaking? What was wrong with him? He looked around the room fuzzily and heard Clary make an odd, surprised sound as if she'd seen something she hadn't expected.
I think it's time to begin, said Jem. Magnus?
Simon could hear Magnus sigh as he stood up. Magnus was really tall. This Simon had always known. Now he looked like he might hit the ceiling. He opened a door that Simon hadn't noticed was there.
Come through here, Magnus said. There are some things you need to see.
Clary got up and went over to the door. Simon followed. Katerina caught his eye as he went. Everything was unsaid in this room. She didn't quite approve of what was happening. Neither did Magnus. Whatever was on the other side of the doorway was utterly dark, and Clary hesitated for a second.
It's fine, Magnus said. It's just a bit cold in there. Sorry.
Clary went in, and Simon followed a step behind. They were in a shadowy space, definitely cold. He turned, but could no longer see the door. It was just him and Clary. Clary's hair shone bright red in the dark.
We're outside, Clary said.
Sure enough, Simon blinked. His thoughts were a little slow and stretched.
Of course they were outside. They maybe could have said we were going outside, Simon said, shivering. No one here believes in coats.
Turn around, Clary said. Simon turned. The door they had just come through, in fact, the entire building they had just come from, was gone. They were simply outdoors, surrounded by just a few trees. The sky above was a purple-gray parchment that seemed to be lit by a low haze of lights on the horizon just out of sight. There was a web of brick paths all around, dotted with fenced-off areas of trees and urns that probably contained flowers in better weather, and now stood as reminders of the season. It was familiar, and yet it was like nowhere Simon had ever been.
We're in Central Park, Clary said, I think.
What? But as soon as he said it, it became clear. The low metal fences that marked off the brick paths. But there were no benches, no trash cans, no people. There was no view of the skyline in any direction.
Okay, said Simon. This is weird. Did Magnus just completely screw up? Can that happen? You guys just came from New York. Do you just open up the same portal?
Maybe, Clary said. Simon took a deep breath of the New York air. It was bitterly cold and burned the inside of his nose, waking him up.
They'll realize in a second, Clary said, shivering in the cold. Magnus doesn't make mistakes.
So maybe it wasn't a mistake. Maybe we just got a free trip to New York, or I did. I'm going to assume that we go wherever we want until they come and get us. You know, they have their ways, might as well take advantage.
This unexpected and utterly sudden trip home had completely reinvigorated Simon.
Pizza, he said. Oh, my God. The stir-fried pizza that I did was the worst. Maybe coffee? Maybe there's time to get to Forbidden Planet.
He patted his pockets.
Money. He had no money.
You?
He asked. Clary shook her head.
In my bag. Back there.
That didn't matter. It was enough to be home. The suddenness of it only made it more wonderful. Now that he looked more carefully, Simon could see clearly the outlines of the skyscrapers that lined the south end of the park. They looked like the blocks he used to play with as a kid. Just a series of rectangles of various sizes, set side to side. Some had the faint glow of signs above them, but he couldn't read the writing. He could, however, see the colors of the signs with an unusual clarity. One sign was a pink rose, a bright bloom. The next was the color of electricity. It wasn't just the colors that were sharp. He could smell everything in the air. The metallic tang of the cold, the sea funk of the East River blocks away. Even the jutting bits of bedrock that reached up and made the many tiny mountains of Central Park seemed to have an odor. There was no garbage, though, and no smells of food or traffic. This was elemental New York. This was the island itself.
I feel a little weird, Simon said. Maybe I should have finished dinner. And now that I've just said that, I know there must be something wrong with me.
You need to eat, Clary said, giving him a light punch. You're turning into a big muscle man.
You noticed?
It's hard not to notice, Superman.
You're like the after photo in some commercial for home workout equipment.
Simon blushed and looked away. It wasn't snowing anymore. It was just dark and open, with many trees around. There was a bright bitterness to the cold.
Where do you think we are? Clary said. I'm guessing about midway.
Simon knew it was possible to walk for some time in Central Park without really having a sense of where you are. The paths wind. The trees create a canopy. The land goes up and down in sharp inclines and declines.
Over there, he said, pointing at a low pattern of shadows. It opens up over there. It's the entrance to something. Let's go that way and look.
Clary rubbed her hands together and huddled against the cold. Simon wished he had a coat to offer her, almost more than he wished he had a coat to offer himself. Still, being cold in New York was better than being cold in the academy. He had to admit, though, that Idris was more temperate. New York weather went to more extremes. This was the kind of cold that would give you frostbite if you stayed out in it too long. They probably needed to figure out where they were and get out of the park and into a building, any building, a store, a coffee shop, whatever they could find. They walked towards the opening, which revealed itself to be a collection of elaborately carved stone plinths. There were several of these, in sets. Eventually they led to an equally elaborately carved staircase that bent on its way down to a wide terrace with a massive fountain. There was a lake just beyond, covered in ice.
Bethesda Terrace, Simon said, nodding. That's where we are. That's in the 70s, right?
72nd, Clary said. I've drawn it before.
The terrace was just a large, ornamental area inside of the park and not really somewhere to be on a cold night. But it seemed to be the only place to be. If they walked toward it, at least they would know where they were, as opposed to wandering around in the trees and looping paths. They walked down the stairs together. Strangely, the fountain was going tonight. It was often turned off in the winter, and certainly when it was freezing cold. But the water flowed freely, and there was no ice on the water in the fountain base. The lights were on, and all focused on the statue of the angel that stood in the middle of the fountain, on top of two layered tiers and four tiny cherubs.
Maybe Magnus did mess up, she said.
Clary walked right up to the low edge of the fountain, sat down, and wrapped her arms around herself. Simon stared at the fountain. Funny, he thought, how they hadn't noticed any lights a few minutes ago as they approached. Maybe they'd just come on.
The angel of the Bethesda Fountain was one of the most famous statues in all of Central Park. Wings extended, water pouring off her outstretched hands. He turned his head back down to tell Clary to look at the statue, but Clary was gone. He spun around, a full rotation. She was nowhere in sight.
"Clary," he called.
There were no real places to conceal yourself on the terrace, and he'd looked away for only a moment. He walked halfway around the base of the fountain, calling her name several times. He looked up at the statue again. Same statue, looking down benevolently, water still dripping from her hands. Except the statue was facing him, and he'd walked to the other side. He should have been looking at the back of it. He took a few more steps. While he never saw anything move, with every step the statue was still facing him directly, her stone expression soft and blank and angelic. Something clicked in Simon's head.
"Pretty sure this isn't real," he said. "Pretty sure."
The evidence now seemed ridiculously obvious. The geography of the park was subtly wrong. He considered the bright glowing sky for a moment, which was now filled with bleached white clouds the size of entire states. They slid along the firmament, as if watching his progress in an embarrassed drive-by fashion. He was certain he could smell the Atlantic Ocean and the rocks and stones.
"Magnus!" Simon screamed. "Are you kidding me? Magnus! Jem! Katerina!"
No Magnus, no Jem, no Katerina, no Clary.
"Okay," Simon said to himself. "You've been in worse situations than this. This is just weird, that's all. Just weird. Just very, very weird. Weird's okay. Weird's normal. I'm in some kind of dream. Something has happened, and I'm gonna figure this out. What would I do if this were D&D?
It was as good a question as any, except the answer had to do with rolling a D20, so maybe it wasn't actually that helpful.
Is this a trap? Why would they send us to a trap? Must be a game, it's a puzzle. If she was in trouble, I'd know.
That was interesting. He had the sudden and complete knowledge that if Clary were hurt, he would absolutely know it. He didn't feel any hurt, he did feel an absence, a pull to locate her. As this thought occurred to him, a very unusual thing happened. Namely, the great stone angel of Bethesda Fountain flapped her wings and flew straight up into the night sky. As she flew, the base of the fountain remained connected to her feet and pulled up the fountain like it was a plant. The massive reservoir of the fountain became unmoored and started to pull toward the sky. The bricks and mortar tore, and a root network of pipes was revealed, and a raw hole in the earth that rapidly filled with water. The ice on the lake cracked all at once, and the entire terrace started to flood. Simon backed up towards the steps as the water spilled out. He retreated slowly, step by step, until the water evened. The lake now incorporated the terrace, 8 steps high. The fountain and the angel were gone.
"That," Simon said, "was weirder than normal."
As he spoke, a sound seemed to tear the night in two. It was a chord, a pure, thundering harmonic that rattled the tympanic bones in his head and physically shook him to his knees. The clouds scattered, as if in fear, and the moon shone clear and full above him. It was a bright yellow, so bright he could barely look at it. He had to shield his eyes and look down. There was a rowboat. This was not so mysterious. It had come loose from the boathouse not far away. All of the boats were floating freely, excited to be out on their own for the evening. But this boat had come all the way over and bumped up next to where he was standing. Also, unlike all of the other rowboats, this one was shaped like a swan.
"I take it I'm supposed to get in," he said,
flinching, in case the sky decided to make any more terrifying noises. There was no reply from the sky, so Simon grabbed the neck of the swan with both hands and carefully stepped inside and sat in the middle. The water couldn't be very deep. He would certainly be able to stand in it if the boat capsized, but still, freezing night, flying fountain, magic boat, and missing Clary, no reason to add falling into cold water to the mix. As soon as he was in it, the little swan boat bobbed off, as if it knew it had somewhere to be. It drifted into the lake, avoiding the other loose boats. Simon huddled in,
wrapping his arms around himself as he took his cold, gentle journey on the lake. The surface was utterly smooth, reflecting the moon and clouds. Simon had never done this before. The whole boating in Central Park thing seemed like it was meant for tourists. But in his recollection, the lake was fairly small and wide. He was surprised when it narrowed very suddenly and made itself into a channel under a thick canopy of trees. Once under the trees, there was absolutely no light at all for several minutes. Then everything lit up at once. Rows of super bright bulbs lined the sides of the channel, and in front of him was a low tunnel with the words Tunnel of Love written around the arch in lights. Bright pink hearts bookended the word.
"You're joking,"
Simon said, for what felt like the millionth time. The air was now thick with the smell of popcorn and sea air, and there were sounds of fairground rides. The swan boat bumped, as if moving onto a track that would take it into the tunnel ride. Simon glided in. The light behind him faded, and the tunnel had a soft blue glow. Some nondescript classical light music played, full of violins. The boat settled into the track. The walls were painted in old-fashioned scenes of lovers, people sitting on porch swings kissing, women lounging on a depiction of a crescent moon, sweethearts leaning over an ice cream soda to kiss. The water was lit from underneath and glowed green, reflecting off the ceiling. Simon looked over the side of the boat to get a sense of how deep it was, or if there was something under him, but it looked shallow, like any normal water ride.
"This is a weird place to meet," said a voice.
Simon turned to see that he was now sharing his little swan with Jace. Jace was standing at the front of the boat, leaning against the swan's head. Being Jace, his balance was perfect, so the boat didn't rock to the side.
"Okay," Simon said. "This is really taking a turn I didn't expect."
Jace shrugged and looked around at the tunnel.
"I suppose these things had a use at one time," he said. "It was probably risque to take this ride. You get a whole 4 minutes of unsupervised necking."
The word necking was bad. Hearing Jace say it was a new kind of bad.
"So," Jace said, "do you want to talk, or should I?"
"Talk about what?" Jace indicated the tunnel around them, as if this was very obvious.
"I'm not going to kiss you," Simon said, "ever."
"I've never heard anyone say that before," Jace mused. "It was a unique experience."
"Sorry."
Simon didn't feel even a little guilty.
"If I was in a guise, I don't think you'd make the top 10.
"Save it," Jace released the swan's head and came to sit down by Simon's side. "I remember how we met. Do you?"
"You're playing a game of what do you remember with me?" Simon asked. "That's classy."
"It's not a game. I saw you. You didn't see me, but I saw. I saw it all."
"Well, this is fun," Simon said. "You and me in the tunnel of what the hell are you talking about?"
"You need to try to remember this," Jace said. "This is important. You need to remember how we met." Whatever this was, a dream, some kind of altered state, it was veering in a very odd direction.
"How is it everything is about you?" Simon said.
"This isn't about me at all. This is about what I saw. This is about what you know. You can get there. You need to get this one back. You need this memory."
"You're asking me to remember somewhere I didn't see you?"
"Exactly. Why wouldn't you have seen me?"
"Because you were glamoured," Simon said.
"But someone did see me." That had to be Clary. Obvious choice, but... Now there was something rocking in the back of Simon's mind. He had been somewhere with Clary, and Jace was there, except Jace wasn't there. That was both in his memory and in the present. Jace was gone. The boat trundled on, turning a corner and plunging back into the dark. There was a short decline and a burst of fog, then the ooh of a cartoon ghost, and the mocked-up entryway of some kind of gothic mansion. The ride had gone from Lover's Lane to Haunted Mansion. Simon rode along, through tableau of the mansion's rooms. In the library, ghosts dangled from wires, and a skeleton popped out of a grandfather clock. This fantasy, or whatever it seemed to be tapping into his memories of going to the Haunted Mansion at Disney World when he was a kid. And yet, as they moved from room to room, things looked more familiar. The cracking stone walls, the threadbare tapestries. The Haunted Mansion was turning into the Academy. There was a ghostly version of the cafeteria and the classrooms.
Over here, Simon.
It was Maya, waving from what looked like an elegant wood-paneled office. There was a sign on the wall behind her, some kind of verse of poetry. Simon only caught a line of it. As old and as true as the sky. Maya wore an elegant suit, her hair clipped back, and gold bangle bracelets on her wrists. She looked sadly at Simon.
"Are you really gonna leave us?" she said.
"Leave being a downworlder? Become one of them?" "Maya," Simon said, lump in his throat. He remembered only bits and pieces of his friendship with her. More than friendship, maybe. How brave she was, and how she'd been his friend when he desperately needed one.
"Please," she said, "don't go."
The boat moved swiftly past to another room, a completely standard apartment living room with some cheap furniture. It was Jordan's apartment. Jordan stepped out of the bedroom doorway. There was a wound in his chest. His shirt was black with blood.
"Hey, Rumi," he said.
Simon's heart felt like it stopped in his chest. He tried to speak, but before he could say a word, everything plunged into darkness. He felt the boat slide off its track with a soft bump, as if it had come to the end of the ride. Everything rushed forward. The tunnel opened out, and the boat lurched forward suddenly and began to speed up, as if it was carried on a current. Simon gripped the bench he sat on to hold himself steady. He had been dumped out on a massive body of water, a river, very wide. Next to him, the New York skyline was dark, the buildings eerily not illuminated, but he could make out their shapes. Not far up on the left side, he could see the silhouette of the Empire State Building. Ahead of him, maybe a mile or so up, there was a bridge spanning the river he was on. He could even make out the shadowy outline of an old-fashioned Pepsi-Cola sign on the right bank. That he knew. The sign was near the base of the 59th Street Bridge to Queens.
"The East River," he said to himself, casting a glance around.
The East River was not somewhere to be at night, in the cold, in a small rowboat shaped like a swan. The East River was dangerous, fast, and deep. He felt something bump the back of his tiny swan, and turned, expecting a trash barge or a freighter. Instead, it was another swan-shaped boat. This one contained a young girl, maybe 13 or 14, in a tattered prom dress. She had long, blonde hair drawn up in uneven pigtails, giving the impression of constant lopsidedness. She pulled her swan to the side of Simon's and, seemingly without a care in the world, pulled up her skirt and stepped from one boat to the other. Simon instinctively reached out one hand to help her and one hand to steady himself. He was sure the transfer would cause their little swan to topple, and while it did sway uncertainly as the weight distribution changed, somehow they stayed upright. The girl dropped herself next to Simon on the bench. The swan was designed for people to cozy up to each other, so she was pressed against his side.
"Hi,"
she said happily.
"You're back."
"I am?" There was something wrong with the girl's face. She was too pale. There were deep circles all the way around her eyes, and her lips were faintly grey. Simon wasn't sure who she was, but he got a very uneasy feeling.
"It's been forever," she said. "But you're back. I knew you'd come back for me."
"Who are you?" She fun-punched him in the arm, like he'd told a great joke.
"Shut up," she said. "You're so funny. That's why I love you."
"You love me?"
"Shut up," she said again. "You know I love you. It's always been you and me. You and me forever."
"I'm sorry," Simon said. "I don't remember." The girl looked around at the churning river and dark buildings, as if this was all very wonderful and exactly where she wanted to be.
"It was all worth it," she said. "You're worth it."
"Thanks."
"I mean, they killed me for you.
They dumped me in a trash can, but I don't hold it against you." The chill was now inside of Simon, as well as out.
But you're looking for her, aren't you? She is so annoying.
Clary? Simon asked. The girl waved her hand, as if blowing away a cloud of unwanted cigarette smoke.
You could be with me. Be my king. Be with Queen Marine. Queen Marine. Queen of death. Queen of the night. I ruled over all of this.
She swept her hand towards the skyline. While it seemed unlikely that this very young girl could have ruled over New York, there was something about the story that rang true. He knew this. It was his fault. He didn't do anything exactly, but he could feel guilt. Terrible, crushing guilt and responsibility.
What if you could save me?
She asked, leaning into him.
Would you?
What if you had to pick? Maureen said, smiling at the thought.
Oh, we could play a game. You could pick me or her. I mean, you're the reason I died, so you should pick me. Save me.
The clouds, ever watchful when something interesting was going on, crowded back. The wind kicked up, and the river took on a heavy wake, rocking the boat from side to side.
She's in the water, you know, Maureen said. The water in the fountain that comes from the lake. The water in the lake that comes from the river. The water in the river that comes from the sea. She's in the water. In the water, in the water.
There was a tremendous pang in Simon's chest, like someone had punched him right in the sternum. Just off the side of the boat, something appeared, something like stone and seaweed. No, a face and a crown of hair. It was Clary, floating on her back, eyes closed. Hair leading the way. He reached out to her, but the water was going too fast, and she was pulled upriver.
You could make it all better, Maureen shouted, jumping up.
The boat rocked.
Who are you gonna save, Daylighter?
With that, she dove off the other side of the boat. Simon grasped the long neck of the swan to hold his balance and scanned the waters. Clary had already floated 20 or more feet away. And Maureen was floating in the same manner, now quiet and seemingly asleep, at about half the distance. There was not a lot of time to think. He wasn't the strongest swimmer, and the undertow of the river would probably pull him down. The cold would render him numb and probably kill him first. And he had two people to save. This isn't real, he said to himself. But the pain in his chest said otherwise. The pain was calling to him. He was also sure that, real or not, when he jumped in the river, it was going to hurt as much or more than anything he'd ever felt. The river was real enough. What was real? What did he have to do? Was he supposed to swim past the young girl and leave her? If he ever made it that far.
Our choices, said a voice behind him.
He didn't have to turn to know it was Jace, balanced elegantly on the tail of the wooden swan.
That's what it's all about. Hard choices. They never get easier.
You're not helping, Simon said, kicking off his shoes.
So you're going in?
Jace looked at the water and cringed.
Even I'd think twice about that, and I'm amazing.
Why do you have to get involved in everything? Simon asked.
I go where Clary goes. The two bodies drifted on.
So do I, Simon said.
And he jumped off the right side of the boat, holding his nose. No diving, no need for theatrics. Jumping was enough, and at least it would keep him upright. The pain of the water was even worse than he thought. It was like jumping through glass. The icy cold crackled all over his body, forcing all the air from his lungs. He reached for the boat, but it drifted off, with Jace at the tail, waving. Simon's clothes were pulling him under, but he had to fight. Hard as it was to move his arms, he stretched out to try to swim. His muscles contracted, unable to function at this temperature. None of them could survive this, and this did not feel like a dream. Being in this water, which was pulling harder now, pulling him down, this was as good as being dead. But something crackled into his mind. Some knowledge that had been well, well pushed away. He had known what it was like to be dead. He had had to claw his way out of the ground. He'd had soil in his eyes and in his mouth. The girl, Marine, she was dead. Clary was not.
He knew this because his own heart was still beating. Erratically, but still beating.
Clary.
He reached out again and struggled with the water. One stroke.
Clary.
Two strokes. Two strokes were ridiculous. The water was faster and stronger, and his limbs were shaking and so heavy. He started to feel sleepy.
You can't give up now, said Jace.
The boat had circled around and was now on Simon's right side, just out of reach.
Tell me what you know.
Simon was not in the mood to be quizzed. The river and the earth itself were pulling him down.
Tell me what you know, Jace insisted.
I...
Simon couldn't make words.
Tell me!
Clary. And what do you know about her?
Simon definitely couldn't speak anymore. But he knew the answer. He would go to her. Alive, dead, fighting the river. Even if his dead body drifted alongside hers, that would somehow have to be enough. The knowledge caused his body to warm just a bit. He kicked against the water.
There you go, said Jace. Now you're getting it. Now, you go.
Simon's entire body shuddered violently. His face dipped below the surface for a moment, and he took on water, which burned him from the inside. He pushed out again, spat it out. One stroke. Two. Three. It wasn't as futile now. He was swimming. Four. Five, he counted them off. Six. Seven.
I know the feeling, Jace said, drifting alongside him. It's hard to explain. They don't make greeting cards for it.
Eight. Nine. The city began to light up. Starting at the ground level, the lights appeared, reaching up towards the sky.
When you realize it, Jace said, you know that you can do anything, because you have to. Because it's you. You're one.
10. 11. No need to count now. Jace and the swan were lagging behind, and now he was alone, swimming on, his body pumping with adrenaline. He turned to look for Maureen, but she was gone. Clary, however, was still clearly visible, floating just ahead. Not floating. Swimming. Toward him. She was doing exactly what he was doing, forcing her body on, shuddering, pushing through the water. Simon powered through the last strokes and felt the touch of her hand. He would go. He would go with her. And she was smiling, her lips blue. And then he felt the ground under him, some surface under the water, something just a foot or two down. Clary reacted at the same moment, and they both grabbed at each other and struggled to their feet. They were standing in the Bethesda fountain, the angel statue looking down on them, pouring water on their heads.
You,
Clary said. Simon didn't try to speak. He embraced her, and they shuddered together before stepping carefully out of the fountain and lying down on the bricks of the terrace, heaving for breath. The moon was wide, and too close. Mentally, Simon told the moon to stop being so close and bright, and that it should generally shut up with the mooniness. He reached out and took Clary's hand, which was already extended, waiting for his. When he opened his eyes, he was not outside. He was on something fairly comfortable and plush. Simon reached around and felt a velvety surface under him. He sat up and realized he was on a sofa in the reception room. The tea set was there in front of him. Magnus and Katerina were standing against the wall, conferring, and Jem sat in the chair between them and watched them both.
Sit up slowly, he said. Take a few deep breaths.
What the hell?
Simon said. You drank water from Lake Lynn, Jem said quietly. The waters produce hallucinations.
You had us drink water from Lake Lynn? Where's Clary?
She's fine, Jem said quietly. Drink some water. You must be thirsty. A glass was already against Simon's lips. Katerina was holding it.
Are you joking? Simon said. You want me to drink that after what just happened?
It's fine, Katerina said. She took a long sip from the glass and held it back in front of Simon's mouth. He did have a crazy case of cotton mouth, actually. His tongue felt thick. He took the glass and drank it back in one go, then filled it again and again from a pitcher on the table. Only after the third glass did he feel like he could speak again.
Doesn't that drive people insane? He said, not bothering to disguise his anger in any way. Jem sat calmly, his hands resting on his knees.